Nikolai Razuviev lives in Australia now, but he grew up in a place called the North Caucasus, which is a stretch of land between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. It's kind of where Southern Europe meets Asia. When Nikolai was growing up, it was part of the old Soviet Union, and it was ruled from faraway Moscow under the Brezhnev government. Like most kids, Nikolai loved riding bikes, and as a young boy, he was singled out as a future cycling champion and potential Olympic gold medalist. But he admits the real lure of the sport for him and so many other cyclists wasn't so much national glory, it might have been a bit of that, but it was more the chance for travel, for a better life, and the opportunity to escape death on a foreign battlefield, probably Afghanistan. Nikolai, welcome to Conversations. Hello.
Hi, Richard.
Tell me about this town you grew up in. It was called Nalchik, is that how you say it?
Yeah, it was called Nalchik. It's a relatively small town by Russian standards. I think when I was growing up in there, it was only maybe 250,000 people. So it was relatively small, quite beautiful. It's next to huge mountains, very clean, very green. But of course, as most Soviet towns, it had its own problems, and it was an interesting place to grow up.
Yeah, what kind of memories do you have of play, you know, playing as a kid around a town like that?
We spent, like, unlike kids in Australia, I guess, we spent a lot of time outside, especially during the holidays, summer holidays. Our winters were mild.
No iPads then?
No, internet, nothing. No. I was just recently thinking how our childhood was different from the kids today. We didn't have any internet. We had a lot of books. I used to spend a lot of time going through photographs, family photographs, or encyclopedias, or dictionaries, or things like that, you know, just to entertain myself, because there was nothing on TV. And yeah, playing outside was a huge part of it.
Tell me a bit about your parents, where your parents are from.
My father is from Grozny, which is the capital of Chechnya, and my mother is from an area. Well, the city is called Kuybyshev, and it's now renamed back to its original name, which is now called Samara. It's on the Volga River, and Volga River is, I think, the biggest river in Russia.
Yeah. So your dad grew up in Chechnya, and we know what Chechnya is these days. It's you know, kind of...
Yeah.
He's just completely destroyed and then rebuilt and destroyed again. But this, of course, was before all this happened.
Yeah. He's from Grozny. Back then, of course, there was... the time was a lot peaceful in that sense. There was no violent tensions, at least between different ethnic groups. But he just moved from, at some point, I think he moved from Grozny to Nalchik.
How did your parents meet?
My father was in the army in that city where my mother used to live, and they somehow met during his service in the army.
How did he court her?
I don't know. I tried to a few times ask him this kind of question, because there is a story, you know, of him and her coming back to Nalchik unannounced. You know, his mother didn't know that he got married. So they just rocked up in this American Buick car, which was very unusual. You know, the car ownership was very, very low. You know, not many people had cars.
What was a Buick doing in the North Caucasus?
I don't know. If he was coming from Moscow, I guess it would have been explained in more or less rational way, because there were embassies and foreign missions and trades and whatnot. When he was coming from the middle of Russia driving this American 40th built Buick, and obviously his mother, you know, was very surprised to see not only the Buick, but, you know, the woman came out of the car and he said, "Hi, Mom, I'm back from the army, and this is my wife." So, yeah, that's how they arrived in Nalchik.
What was your dad like to you? Was he? How do you remember him?
My dad was quite reserved. He actually liked sport. He never smoked, which was very unusual for a man in Russia. You know, most men smoked. He never smoked. He was playing soccer at some time, I think. He told me, I've seen, that's what I mentioned, going through family's photos. I've seen a lot of photos of him in a soccer team. So he played soccer at amateur level. He liked sports, and he was a very strong, very kind of bull-built man. I remember him waking up early in the morning, doing exercise and keeping himself in in shape.
How was he with you? Was he engaged, an engaged father with you? Did he do a lot with you?
Not much. As I said, he was quite reserved. We played chess. You know, he taught me chess. We played. He was a really, really good chess player. So he wasn't someone who talked a lot, and he just kept to himself pretty much.
What did he tell you about his experiences in the Second World War, you know, where the German army came sweeping through and was pushed back and forth? What did he tell you about that?
He was a kid. I think he was a teenager at the time, because the German army reached Caucasus 43 or 44. I think it was the end of German invasion. They were charging to oil fields around Caspian Sea. They never reached it. So those areas where my father lived at the time, they were quite a last frontier for the Germans to reach. And of course, they were quite, the kids and the population was quite, or some of it at least, were quite hostile. So he was telling me stories about how they were trying to stop the army. Obviously, you know, they couldn't stop it, but they tried their little tricks, you know, throwing nails on the roads when the cars were going through the city and stuff like that.
Throwing nails on the road in front of the German army is a very, very dangerous thing, I would have thought, to do.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I mean, they were basically looking at having a little bit of fun, but also looking at death. You know, these guys wouldn't muck around.
How about your mum? What did she recall from that time?
Well, she was away. She was from the war. She was growing up in the city of Kuibyshev, and Germans never reached that area at all. All she remembers of the war was German prisoners of war. She saw a lot of them. You know, there were a lot of, you know, that Battle of Stalingrad. Mm-hmm. Stalingrad is just probably a couple of hundred kilometers from Kuibyshev.
That's arguably one of the worst things that ever happened to anyone in history, is to live through the Battle of Stalingrad.
Yeah. It was, from probably people know from the history books, it was a devastating battle. Yeah. It was huge. I think a couple of million people were involved in the whole battle. So she was not far away from that, but the Germans never reached her city. And as you know, a lot of Germans were captured during that battle. So a lot of them were sent to farms and just work as a prisoners of war. And she saw a lot of them, and I think she felt quite pitiful toward them and helped them with food and, you know, just little things as much as they could, even though, you know, They obviously knew about all the atrocities that the Germans were doing to in Russia, but yeah, they just helped.
Part of the world you grew up in is it went through an extraordinary time during the war. I mean, I've read stories that Stalin pretty much evacuated the entire population of Chechnya to Kazakhstan. I mean, the whole population there, and people eventually came back in dribs and drabs. So there must have been a kind of, I don't know, volatile ethnic mix amongst the peoples where you grew up. Did you see much evidence of that?
Yeah, we were growing. Yeah, there's a lot of there's deep roots of animosity between ethnic groups and Caucasus. I mean, the Soviet Union itself, I remember from school days, we were told that Soviet Union was populated with more than 100 different ethnic groups. So most people think of Russia as a place of where Russians live. Mm-hmm. But as I said, there were more than 100 different ethnic groups. Anywhere you go in Russia, you meet different ethnic groups, different people speak, you know, different languages. And in Caucasus in particular, I wouldn't say it's densely populated, but there's a lot of ethnic groups living in a small area.
Does that mean fights would break out between kids?
Yeah. We had this, obviously, the Chechens in particular. They remembered what happened to their fathers and their grandfathers who were uprooted and sent to Kazakhstan, you know, thousands of kilometers away from their land. And these guys are very, very attached to their land. You know, they love their land, the mountains and the rivers and whatnot. So they had this grudge against the Russians, and it was always there. And when I was growing up, obviously I didn't grow up in Chechnya. We were next to Chechnya, but it's the same story with everywhere. Stalin uprooted one of the ethnic groups where I was growing up, and they're called Balkars. And for some reason, he didn't trust particular ethnic groups.
He was from that part of the world,
exactly,
wasn't he?
So he knew something we don't know. And there was a lot of divisions, ethnic divisions when I was growing up, a lot of fights,
Did you have to fight as well?
Yeah, I had to, you know.
They taught you to fight.
My brother, who was 11 years older than me, when I went to school, he already left by this time. I think he got married, so he was away from the family. I was pretty much growing up by myself in my family. And we had this conversation before I went to school. He told me that I'll have to stand up for myself. I think he said there would be a lot of violence, a lot of fights. And he said, you have to fight. And he said, the best way to do it is to strike first. He said, every time you see or feel any tension growing, happening around you, just strike and then ask questions later. Oh,
and did you try that? Did it work?
Well, I had to. It was a survival thing.
You must have gotten tons of fights because of that.
Yeah, at some point they were quite regular. I think when we reached the age of maybe 15, 16, they kind of stopped. I think we were old enough to realize that was stupid. But back when we were 11, 12, 14, yeah, there was a lot of it happening pretty much on a daily basis.
Do you remember your first bike that you got?
Yeah, I got it from my father. I was asking for all my friends had bikes, and I just kept going on and on and on. Can you buy me a bike? Can you buy me a bike? But they just couldn't afford it. It was quite expensive. And then one day he comes home and says, let's go. And he takes me to, it wasn't even a bike shop. We didn't have bike shops. It was a sports shop where you buy balls and whatever, you know, sports equipment. And there were bikes. And he bought me a bike. And it was one of the happiest days of my life. And
can you still picture it?
Yeah. It's a bike that he would probably see on old pictures from the 30th and 40th, you know, a very simple one gear. It wasn't a fixed gear, but it was just one gear, a brake, two wheels, and a frame.
Right. And the same, you know, I suppose there was like one, it wasn't like a whole lot of brands you can choose from, is it? There's just like one.
One, yeah.
One of everything?
One, yeah, yeah.
One
yeah,
bike.
Yeah.
One kind of helmet, one kind of this, one kind of
no
that.
Helmets.
No helmets, right.
We had no helmets clothes.
That's really dumb.
Still don't.
Right. what was your parents' attitude to the system in which they grew up under? Because, I mean, this is, I don't know, I suppose this is Khrushchev, Brezhnev era. It's not Stalin at this point. How did they, were they resigned to things?
Yeah, at some point, they grew up with Stalin. Stalin died in 1953, so my parents were born in 31, so they were 20 something by this stage, so they have experienced a lot of Stalinism. I guess they even see some people disappear from their apartments and places, but
the spirit never come back.
Their attitude was pretty much kind of whatever, you know. They I think they believed at some point in the idea of communism being built in Soviet Union. But I guess at some point they realized it was all a lie, it was all unachievable, and they just basically went just whatever.
Was that common amongst people at the time, or were most people cynical about it, or were there many, many people who believed the stories that they were being told?
I've never met anyone who sincerely believed in it. There was a lot of hypocrisy and officially, and there was a lot of official stories, so to speak. People would say things that were politically correct, but you can see through them that they are not believing them.
What do you think when you see like footage of North Korea today? Does that remind?
Yeah, it reminds me. It reminds me of the Soviet. In fact, you know, I think they took it to a next level, because I used to have friends, musicians, who used to travel to North Korea with concerts to support them or whatever. But when they were coming back from visiting North Korea, they were telling me horrible stories. I mean, we were living not in a very free society, but they were telling me that North Korea was much, much worse.
Was your family able to create some space for a private life within that kind of a system? Was there, could you just live with the state to one side and just live your own life outside of that? Is that possible at that time?
Private lives, yeah, as long as you don't the system basically allowed you to have your own life as long as you do not speak up. So if you keep it quiet, even, you know, a lot of people were making money on the side, you know, incomes were fixed, but a lot of people are making money on the side because they wanted things that were not available, so they were only available on the black market, you know, jeans and t-shirts and whatnot. As long as you don't scream out loud, I'm rich or I'm making money, you were okay. Or as long as you don't stand up and say, well, I don't like how things are run, or I don't like the system. In fact, this kind of talk was against the law, so you would end up in prison or in a psychiatric institution. So it was possible. Yeah, it was possible if you do it in a smart way.
Yeah, because people were put in psychiatric institutions because the thinking was, if you didn't like the government, well, you must be insane.
Yeah, that was the approach. That was the approach to treat people as basically crazy and sick mentally. Mm-hmm. If you like, the idea was, you know, how could you not agree or not like communism or socialism if it's so beautiful and so nice? You know, everyone is wealthy, so to speak, and everyone is has everything they want. And, you know, it was this utopia that they were talking about. And if you don't like it, you must be insane.
What were you told about the outside world, life in the West?
It was pictured. That's why I was so shocked when I visited the Western country for the first time. We were told, and the pictures were seen on TV, on television, radios, and propaganda material, was that the West was not necessarily poor, but they pictured a picture of a small number of people extremely rich, and everybody else is very, very poor. A lot of exploitation, a lot of persecution of people with different views and all that. So they were pretty much painting what the Soviet Union was, really, with Western window dressing, so to speak.
Did you have any contact at all with Western popular culture, like, you know, magazines or radio or TV or something from Western countries?
Yeah, we had some things managed to filter through, like music. You know, back then there was no CDs, so there were record players. So we had a lot of records circulating in Soviet Union. They were very expensive. I got into music myself. I was really big fan of bands like Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple, but they were insanely expensive to buy, so I had to save if I wanted to buy a record. And they were all secondhand, obviously. A new one would be very expensive. So things were going through, like magazines, but of course most magazines were in foreign languages. We didn't know anything, so you only look at pictures. And that's where all these ideas were coming from. You know, they were telling us one thing, but we were looking at the pictures and seeing quite the other. Especially, I remember one magazine. It was actually published in Russian, and it was published by some sort of American society or embassy, I don't know. It was called America, and it was in Russian. And I only saw secondhand copies at my friend's place because his father was a librarian, and somehow they got this magazine.
And what was in America, the magazine?
Well, funny thing is that there were pictures of these cars, and there were prices on those cars. And I remember because, the exchange rate was not real. It was artificial. So $1 was 60 Soviet kopeks, which is like 60 cents. So you look at a $3,000 car in the 70s, and you convert it to rubles, and it's like 1,500 rubles.
Nothing.
Right? And you're thinking, like, our cars are like 10,000. Well, how come American car in America is only 1,500? And that's where all these thoughts are beginning to go into your mind about what's going on there.
So how were you then singled out as a kid as a potential cycling star, Nikolai?
It came by pretty much by an accident. I was just riding that bike that my father bought me. We were riding on the streets, just having fun. And my future coach was having a training session with his guys, and there was this loop that they were doing about 4Ks.
And how old are you at this stage?
I was 12. So he spotted me. I don't think he saw anything outstanding right away. He just saw a fit kid, you know, a slim kid who was riding a bike. So he actually was looking for kids of my age to join his cycling school. He had a bit of shortage. So he just stopped us. There were four of us. He just stopped us, and one guy was overweight, so he didn't even talk to him. But two guys like myself and my friend were fit enough, I think, in his eyes. So he just invited us to his school. That's how it started.
And were you keen?
I was super keen because I saw, you know, those guys were training, and every 5-6 minutes they would pass by on these racing bikes, and I had a street bike, you know, with just handlebars, and it wasn't a racing bike, but these were racing, true racing bikes. and I knew my family could never ever afford to buy one. So I was just keen to try. I had
to upgrade bikes.
Yeah, yeah.
You wanted a bike upgrade, and that's
yeah.
It.
Right. Well, I was having just thoughts of having a go at the racing bike for a couple of days, and then I quit because that's what I did with all other sports. I tried soccer and boxing and fencing and whatnot, and I was just thinking I would quit that as well as soon as I tried the racing bike.
So, what kind of training were you doing as a teenager?
It started slow, really. We started maybe with a couple of hours each day, 5 days a week. It was really nothing special. But then, you know, year after year, it was growing and growing. The distances, the volume started to grow. And eventually, when I was hired by the Titan team, which was like a Soviet version of a professional team, the volume had more than doubled. Yeah, it was at some point three times a day, not just a week. So we had a training in the morning, 40K in the morning. Then 4 or 5 hours after breakfast, that was before breakfast, the first ride, and then a so-called recovery ride, again, 40K before supper.
So these days, of course, the diet of a champion cyclist is, you know, scientifically calculated and very precise. How was it for you as a Soviet cyclist in the late 70s, early 80s?
Well, for us, we worried about things not to eat rather than what to eat, because obviously there was a lot of rubbish coming through what we had to eat. You know, food's basically not suitable for a cyclist before a ride, you know, fatty foods and meat and things like that. So we had to figure out a way of feeding ourselves on something that would give us energy, but at the same time was not harmful for our health. So that was our problem.
Tell me about the first stage race that you did when you were just 16.
Well, back then, I guess maybe this philosophy still holds true in Soviet or in Russia, I would say. A lot of coaches believe that young riders should man up in senior stage racing. So they would just throw in into a very hard race and just see how you go.
And you were told this? You were told you needed to man up, were you?
Yeah, that was a constant teaching, so to speak, a constant philosophy, man up.
So why is that? Is it much more difficult for a 16-year-old to ride with, I don't know,
the age difference. You know, when you're young, 14, 16, the even 1-2 years difference is quite substantial. It feels a lot because the 18-year-old guy is just by definition a lot stronger than 16-year-old one.
So you're thrown in with these older guys, and what happened?
We were thrown in, and myself and my teammates, and this stage race was not only hard in terms of guys who were racing with us, but the climate was very harsh. It was very cold. It was very early spring, so there was a lot of rain mixed with snow and tough roads, a lot of crashes, you know, punctures, and you know, it was just so tough in terms of not only the racing itself, but the environment was really, really hard.
How do you ride in sub-zero or 0 degrees? I mean, don't your hands freeze?
Yes, they do. You know, the first stage, I remember, we arrived in the city, and actually, when we left Nalchik, it was snowing. There was a snowstorm. It was one of those late snowstorms.
You're racing through a snowstorm?
No, we did not race through the snowstorm, but we were on the bus, you know, traveling to that city that was probably 6-7 hours away from my city. And I'm traveling in the bus thinking, oh, this race is not going to happen because it's a snowstorm. But we arrived in that city was called Maikop. So we arrived there, and the snowstorm stopped, but it was still snowing a little bit. And we were starting to change into our, you know, racing kit. And I see these, you know, they have these clocks on city, sort of on the city, and I see 6 degrees. And it's snowing and it's raining. It's all wet. And I'm thinking this is going to be fun. And obviously in about 10, 15 minutes, both my feet and my hands had frozen, and I couldn't feel the brakes, couldn't feel the gears. It was horrible.
Tell me about the racing kit you would wear in these kinds of things. Was it Lycra?
No. We didn't have Lycra then. We, you know, the shorts were wool, pure wool. The jerseys were wool. So you can imagine when they get wet, you know. Water doesn't leave those things, you know. You're just having, you know, a couple of kilos of extra weight on you.
It chafes as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A nasty rash, won't it?
Yeah. Pretty much every time, yeah, you have this saddle sores. And plus, if you race in these conditions two, three times, 2-3 days in a row, the sand gets stuck in your shorts and then it doesn't leave. You know, you need to have a proper washing machine kind of washing to get the sand out. So it would, yeah, chaff and.
But you were there to man up, weren't you?
Well, yeah, that was the idea. Yeah, that was the idea, you know, just to man up. That was the whole idea, the whole point.
So there you are in your first stage there with hands and feet completely frozen, wearing this kind of semi-frozen woolen kit that you've got around you. You're not a happy man at this stage.
No, not at all. I had a little, on a second or third stage, I had a little crash. Nothing serious, but I injured my hand, so it was... I lost some skin on my hand, so couldn't hold to the handlebars. And then we had this day off, and then after the day off, we're standing on the start line, hoping, you know, for more or less...
A better start. Tell me where you'd stay each night. You were going back to the same kind of workers' resort to stay in at night. What was this like?
Yeah, the race organizers gave us to stay in a kind of workers' resort. Yeah, it was just a few buildings in a nice place next to mountains. But because it was early spring, it was early March, they were empty. So because they were empty, they cut off all the heating. So there was no heating in the buildings. So what you have is that you have the horrible racing cold conditions, and then you come back into a very cold building, which not is heated. And the environment is like, as I said, 6-10 degrees outside.
So hot water? Do you get a shower at the end of the day?
No, but in the building there was no hot water, and the first experience of having to look for a shower was a little bit interesting. We came back from our first stage, running back to the building, hoping to have a hot shower in order to warm up, and my coach is standing in front of a building, and you know, he stopped us, says, you know, there is no showers in the building. I mean, there are showers, but there is no hot water. And we're like, what do we do now? He says, oh, over there, there's a boiler's room where you can go, and there is a shower, one for the whole, almost the entire race, because, well, some guys stayed elsewhere, but probably about 70-80% of the entire peloton was staying in that resort. So I picked up my, you know, dry clothes, and I go to that shower. I walk and open the door into the boiler's room, and I see these mountains of coal, you know, because this boiler room was run on coal, so it was heating something, not the resort. I don't know what they were heating, but it was this coal, all dirty, and in at the end of the room, all made of brick, you know, it's all kind of very old building, and at the end of the room I see maybe four or five showers, and this room is filled with, I don't know, 70-80 guys naked, all naked, because they have to wait for their turn to take a shower. There's only five showers available. So you have to undress and you have to wait for your turn. Otherwise, you will miss your turn. And I'm 16, you know. I mean, I've seen naked men before. We showered together with my teammates in environments sort of similar to that. But I've never seen, you know, 70-80 naked and grown-up men standing, you know. Some of them are, you know, bleeding. All of them are dirty and all of them are not happy. And we are little kids, you know, 16 years old. Yeah, it was quite an experience.
So you get a day off and you're feeling a lot better, and that's when you start the fifth stage. Tell me how that unfolded for you, the fifth stage of this stage race.
Yeah, the fifth stage, I was hoping for good weather, but it wasn't happening. It was still raining and snowing together. So I was standing on the start line, and the commissar, who is a race official, came up, and he usually comes up before the peloton, and he explains what's going to happen, how the race is going to unfold, you know, if there are any dangers or anything like that. So he says, up 25K up the road, there is roadworks. He said the asphalt has been removed. It's only about 5K, and that's what you have to go through. And, you know, we were all angry, you know. It's already tough as it is, but then we have to ride through this mud. So guys started swearing, and, you know, on this guy, and you are this and you are that, and then just get into a bit of a exchange of words. And then next thing you know, he pulls out his starter's gun, shoots, and the race is off. So we're going for this 25K, and then we hit this a section of road which is just filled with huge rocks. They're like little big oranges, you know, they're huge rocks.
Rocks in the middle of mud.
Yeah, they're mixed with sand, and because it's raining, it's really muddy. And this area is very There's a lot of farms, so it's all mixed with mud, sand, and huge rocks. And we're just flying through this thing, and I...
Don't you slow down to go through something like that?
No, you don't. As I learned, you know, the only way to go through is you have to go very, very fast through this section of the road, because if you lose speed, you get stuck, and then it's finished for you. So you have to hit it hard and just keep going and keep going, just pedaling, pushing, 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 and then you're out on the other side. So we went through, you know, nobody crashed as far as I could see. We got at the other end of this section, all muddy, you know, everybody is just sort of covered in mud. And we're like, oh man, this is not good. And then two Ks after this section, we see this guy, the commissar, same commissar, standing with the red flag. And I mean, this race is supposed to be a loop. There was no U-turn or anything like that. There was one big loop, and you come back to where you came from and you finish the race. He's standing with a flag, flagging, which means, you know, it's a U-turn. And then we realize what we are going to do. We're going to U-turn to make a U-turn and go back to where we
back just... through the mud and rocks.
Yeah.
How did the riders respond to this? How did the cyclists respond?
Well,
to this?
What do you do? You know, that was his basically payback to for us being, you know, unhappy about what is going on in the race. So he made us U-turn. What do you do?
This is because you swore at him.
Yeah.
Essentially,
yeah, he wasn't happy of our reaction to a little bit of mud in the race, you know. So he made us U-turn, go back, and that's where the fun started. You know, second time through this mud was not fun at all. That's where people started to fall and crash, and the peloton broke up. So another 5K, you know, we go through this mud, go back, and now we realize we're going back to the start line. So there must be another U-turn because we cannot go back. You know, there's a start line. We only did like 40 or 60K, even less. And sure enough, you know, 2K after this second section, he's standing up again with his red flag and, you know, waving it, and it's another U-turn. And at this point, you know, guys started to, the word got around the peloton, you know, keep your mouth shut because he will make another U-turn and just don't say anything, you know, just go through this and we will be done soon. So,
what a sadist.
Yeah.
So you had to go through it a third time?
Three times, yeah, instead of just once.
And once people got out of that, the third time, out of the swamp?
Oh, the peloton was completely broken up. You know, it was little pieces of three, four, five guys riding up the road. All, you know, a lot of crashes, a lot of trouble.
Were you in a bit of pain at this stage?
Well, obviously, you know, with my injured hand, you know, when you go through, it's not even a road anymore. It's just a bunch of rocks. Your bike is all shaking. There is no suspension or anything like that. Obviously, it was hitting my hands. It was not pleasant. With my saddle sores, it was hell. You know, it was hell on wheels.
How did you get through it? What were you saying to yourself as you were going through this?
We were forbidden by coach to quit. You know, you just could not quit this race. And
what do you mean you couldn't quit? Do you mean you'd be off the team, or is that?
Well, he wouldn't kick you out of the team, but you would be in trouble with your coach, and you don't want to be in trouble with your coach. The order was you just have to finish it. That's what it was.
Did it work? Did it make you all tougher cyclists?
I don't know. I think it. I had a similar experience later on when I had to go through a similar situation as well. It influences you, and obviously makes you into what you are as a racer. You know, next time you come around something like that, you know what to expect, and you've done it before, and you just go, okay, well, let's do it again.
You said you were hired by the Ukrainian team, so you went to live in Kiev. Were you there during the Chernobyl disaster, where the Chernobyl nuclear reactor exploded?
Yeah, soon after, well, a couple of years, I was hired in 83, and the Chernobyl disaster happened in 86. In 86, the peace race was supposed to start in Kiev. You know, they started peace race in 85 in Moscow to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Soviet victory over the German during the Second World War. But in 86, they decided to start it from Kiev. And the peace race usually starts in early May, like 2nd or 3rd of May, or closer to the 9th of May. And the Soviet Federation decided to have a bit of a rehearsal before the peace race. So they made us race the same laps or same routes and same distances that the peace race was going to go through, just to, for the national team, for those who are going to race the actual peace race, to experience. It was we had a bit of an advantage of a home ground, so to speak. So they organized the race. I think there was three or four stages in a peace race. So we did that before. So the Chernobyl catastrophe, I think, happened on the 26th of April. And we arrived in Kyiv on the 28th or 29th.
Did you know about it then?
No, we had no idea. The first thing I noticed that the airport was completely empty because the Soviet government was trying to avoid a panic. So they basically canceled all the flights. The only way to escape Kyiv was by train. And because they didn't tell anyone anything about what happened, Chernobyl was only 100 kilometers away from Kyiv, so it's just next door. And if people were panicking in Sweden and Norway, you can imagine what was going on or could have happened in Kyiv. It's a 3 million people city. So they have canceled all the flights. Only a way to escape was by train or by bus. But not many people knew anything about it. So when we arrived, we heard the rumors, you know, something happened in Chernobyl nuclear station, but we didn't know about Chernobyl nuclear station, you know, and we didn't know what actually happened. So there was absolutely no knowledge of what was going on just basically next door. And 2 days or 3 days later, we had to race. It was a race went on, not the peace race, but this rehearsal race. A couple of stages were under rain. It was raining. And
under rain?
Yeah.
After Chernobyl?
Yeah, and that's, I guess, a lot of people are saying that that's how most of radiation actually gets around. But, you know, it goes in the atmosphere first, and then it just falls down with water, with
rain. Were you or any of your teammates affected? Were you given radiation?
Yeah, later on, a couple of years later, maybe 3-4 years later, one of my teammates, he was not even 30 years old. All of a sudden, bang, he has blood cancer. He dies. Like, in a matter of 2-3 months, he's gone. Then the next one, then the head coach. They all died within, I don't know, less than 10 years.
You were given a job and collected a salary as a factory worker. How often did you actually step inside this factory?
Never. I didn't even know where my factory was.
How did that system work for elite athletes and factory jobs?
Well, because we were officially amateurs, we were not allowed to receive a salary. We were allowed to have stipends, which we were getting anyway, but because they wanted to pay us well, they had this system in place where you would be hired by a factory to do whatever is happening at the factory. But to obviously it was illegal, but how they made it happen is they would talk to someone responsible for hiring people. So they would say, we would give you paperwork for 5 people, but you would only have to pay 3 of them.
So a cycling manager would come to the manager of a factory and say, I've got a problem, you might be able to help me.
Yeah, well, it usually happens through, you know, connections and friendships. You know someone who knows someone. You don't just rock up at the factory and say, hey, I have this proposition for you.
Right,
that's a jail term right away, right there.
Right, okay, so then you bring a bottle of vodka or cognac
Yeah, you bring some cognac, you bring some nice delicacies and you talk.
And how does that conversation go?
I've never been present, but yeah. I would imagine, yeah, after a couple of drinks, a couple of nice sandwiches, they start talking and they would just bring it on. Because, see, the guy who is in charge of hiring someone at the factory, he knows why this guy came to him and he's looking forward for a proposition. You know, he wants to know how much he can make out of the deal. So they just have a couple of drinks and then have a talk and he would say, you know, I would give you paperwork for 5, but you only pay 3 of my guys, so you keep 2 salaries for yourself.
And that's how it is.
Yeah, they're shaking hands and all good.
What was the real incentive for you to become a cyclist and join the team? What was the, apart from the national glory?
At first, my incentive was to avoid the army. You know, we had a compulsory 2 years service in the Soviet army. As you grow up as a kid, you obviously have this views of the army being a bit of romantic, you know, a bit of adventure. But as you reach 15, 16, you begin to realize the army is not something you want to go to. It was a bit of a, it was pretty much like a jail. You know, you're taken away from your family, 2 years away somewhere, you don't know where. At the time when I was growing up and I was 15, 16, Soviet Union was involved in Afghanistan. There was a war in Afghanistan.
That's been forgotten, hasn't it? Then
pretty much, yeah.
The United States was helping arm the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviets.
Exactly.
Which are the kind of guys they're not getting on so well with these days in Afghanistan.
That's
so,
the ironic part of it, yeah. They were helping the guys who are fighting them now.
Yeah.
We were losing thousands and thousands. I had lots of friends who have been killed in Afghanistan. And the area I was growing up, I think because it was Caucasus, a lot of Muslim population, the people were ending up going to Afghanistan from my area a lot. You know, they knew the environment. They grew up in the mountains, so they knew the circumstances of how to fight in the mountains, I guess, in their view anyway, at least. So there was a good chance I would go on to Afghanistan. I mean, not a certain chance, but there was a chance. So when I got into cycling and I realized that it's going to be a long, long, long term and I'm pretty much going to be good at it, my first goal was to avoid the army. And we had a system in a place where if you reach an elite level, if you reach national team level, you'll be secured from going to the army. I mean, you would still to be enlisted, but you would never see a uniform. You would never actually go to the actual army.
So you began to travel to the West to compete in Western European countries. What sort of opportunities were there for cyclists to make a bit of cash on the side in those days?
Yeah, there was a lot of it. That was another attraction. Once you realize that information came from my first coach, who was himself quite a distinguished cyclist. So he was the one who taught me what I'm going to get when I'm going to travel abroad to Western countries. He told me, he taught me all the tricks, how to make money in these travels, and it was really, really easy, and the income was absolutely insane because of some of the things we could bring to the West were really, really cheap for us, like cycling tubulars. You know, we nowadays mostly use clinchers, what's called a clincher, but back then we were using tubulars, and they were really cheap in Soviet Union, and especially with this silly exchange rate with the dollar. They were costing less than a dollar in Soviet Union.
So you're bringing, like, these are bike inner tubes, are they? This is what you're talking about? You're bringing them from the Soviet Union to sell in the West?
Yeah, Soviet-made, you know, very, I wouldn't say lower quality, but not as good as Italian-made and all that. But you pay, you know, $60, $70, $80 in Italy for a tube, and it costs only a dollar in Soviet Union. So you come to Italy, you come to France, and you sell them for 20, 25. They go like hotcakes.
And what are you bringing back into the Soviet Union from the West?
So you make a little, a few hundred dollars in these sort of transactions, and you just buy stereos, T-shirts, jeans, running shoes, and they were very, very expensive in Soviet Union. So you bring it back and sell it.
Isn't that a big risk? I mean, what if you got searched at the airport? And,
well, when you're going out, you know, the tubulars, they're legit, you know. It's spare. Even though each one has 100 tubulars, you know, you don't have to explain to the customs, you know, why do you need 100?
Bumpy roads, and all
that. Yeah, I have a lot of flats.
But coming back in, weren't you ever pinched?
Coming back in, sometimes we would, instead of bringing the merchandise back, we would just choose to bring the cash for a next trip, you know, so you have a lot more cash next time you go abroad. And then, you know, possession of foreign currency was illegal. It was a criminal offense. So we had to basically smuggle them in, you know, put them in a bike, basically just drop it in your frame. You know, you took the saddle out, drop it in the seat tube, put the saddle back in, and nobody would ever look inside the bike.
So then we get to the end of the 1980s, and the Iron Curtain's coming down, and Eastern Europe has its own series of revolutions, and eventually the Soviet Union. Tell me how you then where you went then. You decided to turn pro and go to the West.
Yeah, I missed the boat when the first Soviet-based professional team was organized. Was called Alpha Loom. It was a deal between Soviet Federation and the professional team. So it was totally and 100% Soviet, you know, all 24 riders were from the Soviet Union. So they just basically wiped out the entire almost Soviet national team, was gone in one day. I missed that boat because I was concentrating more on team time trial. That was my specialty. That was the easiest way to make a name for yourself, to make yourself comfortable for the rest of your life. And if you win sort of Olympic Games, you know, you're set. The team time trial was an easy way into this. The road race was more of a lottery, you know, it was more open to other possibilities and circumstances, but not team time trial. So I missed my boat. They were interested in road racers. I had only results in team time trials, mostly. Some road races, but not many. So they just basically didn't select me, and I was a little bit too young as well. I was only 23, even not that. But once this was done, I missed the boat. I thought, well, I'll have to do something about it. I really wanted to go pro. So there were a few teams brewing up in Soviet Union, funded by big businesses, like, for instance, the car manufacturer Lada was one of them. But really, I just couldn't wait. You know, they were not making much progress, and I just took off by myself, just packed up one day and said, see you later. I'm not staying here anymore. I was gone.
Were you ready for life in the West?
No, not at all. See, all my previous trips were for competition, you know, and I've never experienced what the Western life is really all about. You know, I just raced bikes. I stayed in hotels. Food was provided. Everything was taken care of. I really had no idea what the Western life is all about. So when I came there by myself, I remember arriving in Paris, taking just breakfast, you know, it was $40. You know, I had a bill with, I don't know how many francs it was, but I remember I converted into dollars, it was $40. And I thought, this is insane. This is not happening. You know, it's not. And I only had $500 or $600 in my pocket. And then $300 a night per, you know, in a hotel. So, yeah, the reality hit me really, really quick.
When did you decide to quit cycling then?
Well, at the early 90s, I was racing for a Danish team, and I just noticed one day the race speed just went through the roof. This is when the rumors started to spread around about the EPO hitting the market. I had no idea what the EPO was, but then obviously you talk to guys and they explain to you what's happening and what's going on. And I just noticed the speeds were going insane. You know, I couldn't, in races that I was competitive before, I was just not able to stay in the pack. You know, I was being dropped from the peloton.
So there's all these speed records are being broken.
Well, not so much records, just the intensity in races just went insane. And especially going up hills, that's where all the action was happening.
So you were knocked out essentially by the arrival of drugs into the sport.
Yeah, I was shocked. You know, it was, you're coming from a background where you've been taught that you are one of the best in the world. You know, you are strong enough to handle anybody. You know, there's no one stronger than you, so to speak. And you kind of race like that with this mentality, and that's why you competitive, that's why you are very aggressive. But then, bang, all of a sudden, you know, people who you don't actually regard as being your competitors just ride away from you like motorbikes.
Are you furious about that now? I mean, being knocked out like that? And now you know why. You probably had an inkling, but now you know completely how pervasive that drug culture was. And hasn't it ruined the sport?
Well, it did ruin the sport, but I have no regrets. See, I was just thinking to myself, what if I actually followed through my dream and you know, became a full-on pro and racing Tour de France and all that. I would have to take that road. And I had to actually, we had this talk with my wife the other day, and I said, if the choice came to receive a big salary or dope myself or quit, most likely I would choose the doping path. You know, it's that simple. It just, there's no way around it.
That's how it is.
Yeah, you know, it's that's why, you know, I have no grudges against the guys who have done this, and I don't judge them.
You ended up coming to Australia from Canada, and how have you found life in Australia on the other side of the world? You know, it's probably a future you never imagined for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I've seen a lot of countries, obviously mostly European countries, but then I spent a couple of years in Canada, visited US. Australia is different. You know, when we came here, it was really, really different. Different people, different culture, obviously different climate, you know, summer all the time. So we had some adjusting to do, especially with an accent. You know, we are used to Canadian-American accent, very clean English. You know, you just hear everything very R, you know, and all that. In Australia, especially in Brisbane, I guess, There is a bit of sometimes understanding happening, you know, like, what did you say?
Yeah.
And slang, you know. Slang. I remember when someone actually asked us to come along for lunch and bring a plate with us. So we just brought an empty plate, you know, completely puzzled and confused why they ask us to bring a plate. So we just brought empty plates, you know, or come for tea, you know. People ask us, come for tea. So we thought, oh, it's just a cup of tea. So we had a dinner at home. Then you come to our friends for a tea, and then there's a big dinner. So, you know.
Well, it's been great. There's so much more to talk to you about it. But we ran out of time, unfortunately. Nicola, it's been just great speaking with you, and fantastic to get your insights. Come around for tea. Bring a plate. That'd be great sometime.
Yeah, empty plate.
Thank you so much for being my guest.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.